Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
Sharon Olds has written, "The politeness and the prudity of the world I grew up in meant that there were things that were important to me and interesting to me, but I had never read a poem about." She's been writing poems about all those things now for over 40 years. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her collection Stag's Leap, about walking through the end of a marriage she had also praised and opened up to poetry. Her most recent book, Odes, pays homage to aspects of the human body and experience that get bleeped out on public radio to follow FCC rules, including Ode to the Clit, Ode to the Penis, and Ode to the Tampon. So the conversation you're about to hear has parental advisories, but please don't let that stop you. It is a joy.
Maybe one reason I do not wear makeup is to scare people. If they're close enough, they can see something is different with me, something unnerving, as if I have no features. I am embryonic, pre-eyebrows, pre-eyelids, pre-mouth. I am like a water bear talking to them, or an amniotic traveler, a vitreous floater on their own eyeball, human ectoplasm risen on its hind legs to discourse with them.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. This conversation unfolded in Newark, New Jersey, at the 2018 Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival.
This is a lively Sunday morning crowd, which leads right into where I want to start, which is that you speak often about having had a hellfire and brimstone Calvinist upbringing, and then your first book was called Satan Says, so I think that tells us where you went with that. But I wonder how, how you would start to describe the religious and spiritual background of your childhood as it appears to you now, because I think, like many things in childhood, what we see changes as we look back at it across time.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me here. Well, I would say that even before I was born, I was a pagan dancer, I would say. I was upside down, and I was engaged in rhythm. I don't remember this, but it just seems true that the heartbeat and the breath and the borborygmy, the sounds of this digestion. So I was gradually hearing that. So I think all my childhood I was a pagan. Underneath the burden of the particularly negative vision of Christianity that I was in the house of. My senses were super pleasurable to me, and there was so much gorgeous beauty in the garden, and, you know, small garden, and a brick barbecue, homemade, in which I could bake pies with lattice crusts, braided lattice crusts made of dirt. So there was so much that was beautiful and good, and music. And then I just tended to dance around. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know when I got the message that I was odd, but I sure got it. And it kind of, I mean, I tried to be normal almost all my life. But now I figure we're all normal enough. Each of us is normal. Each of us is weird.
Yeah.
That's my feeling now.
Yeah. You know, there was something I read that the Guardian wrote a piece about you after you became the first American woman to win the T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry. Mm-hmm.
And in there was the story of the reaction you got when you first submitted your work to a magazine in the early 1970s, when they told you, do you know which one, do you recall that story?
Yes, I was submitting poems in 75, 6, 7, 8, and one magazine wrote back, if you wish to write about your children, may we suggest the Ladies' Home Journal? We are a literary magazine. It wasn't that atypical of, you know, back in the 70s.
Yeah, you write as a woman. You don't merely write about being a woman, but even if you did, you know, what this all... I mean, what it is to be a woman is such a robust and essential elemental variation on the theme of what it is to be human. It seems to me that you just decided, against a grain, that that was interesting and important to you, and it was interesting and important to write about, to give voice to.
Yes, I didn't decide. It just was so interesting to me, and loving dance and sexuality and... I mean, I think almost every poem of mine that's a sexual poem is a sexual love poem. I don't think I've written much in the area. Is there such a thing as the area of pure sex? I haven't gone there. But I just wrote about the things that interested me the most. A poem would come to me, and so I just... wrote what came out of my pen, out of my arm, connected to my soul and mind and body. And the fact that it hadn't been done much was like, oh, it was like, I don't know, it was exciting to be writing maybe the first poem about a diaphragm. I didn't know that until someone told me that. So for
no one had ever in history written about a poem about a diaphragm before.
Someone said that to me.
Yeah.
So
I think you probably have a lot of firsts in there. I mean, we're going to just dive really deep into that. I do though want to note in this book as well, because it's the dead and the living, and I think you pick up on something that also runs all the way through your work, which is the love that we have for our children, and the intimacy, that particular intimacy is there. There's one short poem that I just found, it captures so much in so few words, which is, of course, what poetry does, right? Exclusive. Do you remember this one?
Oh, yeah.
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 Yeah. Huh. So this book came out in 84. So the poem would have been written maybe 2 years before then. So maybe 10 years old, 12 years old. Exclusive for my daughter. I lie on the beach watching you as you lie on the beach, memorizing you against the time when you will not be with me. Your empurpled lips, swollen in the sun and smooth as the inner lips of a shell, your biscuit gold skin glazed and faintly pitted like the surface of a biscuit, the serious knotted twine of your hair. I have loved you instead of anyone else, loved you as a way of loving no one else. Every separate grain of your body building the God as you were built within me, a sealed world. What if from your lips I had learned the love of other lips, from your starred gummed lashes the love of other lashes, from your shut quivering eyes the love of other eyes, from your body the bodies, from your life the lives. Today I see it is there to be learned from you, to love what I do not own.
Yeah, to love what I do not own.
Yeah. I changed it while I read it. on the page it says, like a god, as I had built you within me, and I said, as you were built within me. Mm-hmm. And the next time that's about to reprint, they'll send me the book and ask, do you have any changes, Sharon? Oh, my God. So, yeah, little things like that. I didn't do it. It happened in me.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being, today with the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Sharon Olds. It's interesting that that especially fierce kind of love also has this, from the very beginning, this certainty that the flourishing of that life will mean separation from us.
Yeah.
That we don't own that love. I mean, we don't ever own any love, but we
right.
we have that illusion with other loves, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I want to move through a few of your books, but there's something also in this book about your son. And I'm thinking a lot right now about being the mother of a son.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you would read that. There's one in this, 68. So these two, I feel, and then maybe let's talk about that and how that kind of, what that this poetry surfaces for this conversation.
Okay. So you'd like me to read these two?
I think so.
Yes, thank you.
If you're all right, if that sounds good.
I am so all right.
Okay.
This is like a dream of heaven. Okay. And you make such an excellent God, I must say. Right. Son, coming home from the women-only bar, I go into my son's room. He sleeps, fine, freckled face thrown back, the scarlet lining of his mouth shadowy and fragrant, his small teeth glowing dull and milky in the dark, opal eyelids quivering like insect wings, his hands closed in the middle of the night. Let there be enough room for this life, the head, lips, throat, wrists, hips, penis, knees, feet. Let no part go unpraised. Into any new world we enter, let us take this man.
Mm-hmm. That was 96.
Thank you. My son, the man. Suddenly, his shoulders get a lot wider, the way Houdini would expand his body while people were putting him in chains. It seems no time since I would help him put on his sleeper, guide his calves into the shadowy interior, zip him up and toss him up and catch his weight. I cannot imagine him no longer a child, and I know I must get ready, get over my fear of men. Now my son is going to be one. This was not what I had in mind when he pressed up through me like a sealed trunk through the ice of the Hudson, snapped the padlock, unsnaked the chains, appeared in my arms. Now he looks at me the way Houdini studied a box to learn the way out, then smiled and let himself be manacled. Now, if I was writing that poem now, I've learned so much since I wrote that poem. I would not be able to have chains in a poem without referring to the atrocious history of our country and without referring to my son's good fortune in blending in by being white and being a WASP and all of that. So I also didn't realize that my kids would grow up to be grown-ups like me and my former husband, imperfect people. I mean, my kids are wonderful people, but they're, you know, no person is perfect. Somehow a little kid can seem so perfect.
Yeah.
And then you're going to do you're not going to make the mistakes your parents made, but I didn't realize how many other mistakes were available
that
to be
so
made.
That is so true. So true. So. I know, isn't it? It's so odd that we can endeavor to do it so much better, to parent so much better than we were parented. And objectively, you know, you could make a case that many of us do. And yet, what we are raising are humans.
And
they end up having flaws and neuroses and their issues. And that's also part of how they become who they are and how they...
Yeah. Yes.
Are you thinking these days about being the mother of a son and the men in our lives? And
well, I'm certainly thinking about men. I'm between boyfriends, so I'm always thinking about men.
Well, like this line. This may just be me. We won't dwell here, but this line: "Into any world we enter, let us take this man."
Right, and the thing about being afraid of men, I was raised to be afraid of men. I was raised to not feel safe if I was the only person on the block, and then there was also a man, any man, or boys, especially more than one. It just was a time when many males felt that very little respect for females and anger of desire. And when I was 13, my classmate was kidnapped and raped and murdered in Berkeley, California. Mm. And that, of course, showed us all a little bit from the outside of that family what was possible. Mm-hmm. And being afraid of men, like afraid they'll think I'm ugly and, you know, just all kinds of fears. I was in a wonderful marriage, and so I wasn't afraid of my former husband. Mm-hmm. And I probably was a little bit of a sexist as a parent, but not in the way you'd think, but more like thinking boys needed more encouragement, maybe. Because it was harder for them to learn all that fine motor stuff and even some of the large motor stuff. But we talked about everything, my kids and I, so I think I did my best. Mm-hmm. I think that was the best I could do.
I guess what I'm just what's on my heart now is that there's so much unfinished work we have to do as women and for women and in terms of gender. And yet I also think that we have to do it together with men. And right? Mm-hmm. And when it was to let men come, you know, there's something about that line again, like take them with us. Anyway, that's and because also there are good men in our lives, right?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
a lot of them are here at this conference.
And a lot of them are here. Poetry reading men. It's so interesting to me that so here we've had a flavor of the depth and breadth and profundity of what you are writing about and the voice you're writing in. Mm-hmm. And you won the Pulitzer for Stag's Leap, which was about the end of your marriage. And I don't know. I'm sure other poetry has been written about divorce, so I don't know if this was a world first, but I do feel like the way you fulsomely wrote about the experience from many different places along the spectrum of that experience, and I think the fact that you loved and honored the marriage that was ending also gave a certain character to the poetry. I wonder if I asked, is there one poem in that book, Stag's Leap, that you would like to read that you now appreciate at this remove?
There's one I read often that I read to the high school kids because I realized it's a good poem for high school kids. It's called Known to Be Left. And it's early on. Yeah, it's at page 18. I wrote an awful lot of poems in the maybe 4 years in which this book was written, most of them in the first year. What did I say?
18.
Thank you. It doesn't always seem to be in our hands how open we can be in our poems and how we can tell a truth that is a little bit under the surface of the truth. Known to be left. If I pass a mirror, I turn away. I do not want to look at her, and she does not want to be seen. Sometimes I don't see exactly how to go on doing this. Often, when I feel that way, within a few minutes, I am crying, remembering his body or an area of it, his backside often, a part of him just right now to think of, luscious, not too detailed, and his back turned to me. After tears, the chest is less sore, as if some goddess of humanness within us has caressed us with a gush of tenderness. I guess that's how people go on, without knowing how. I am so ashamed before my friends to be known to be left by the one who supposedly knew me best. Each hour is a room of shame, and I am swimming, swimming, holding my head up, smiling, joking, ashamed, ashamed. Like being naked with the clothed, or being a child, having to try to behave while hating the terms of your life. In me now, there's a being of sheer hate, like an angel of hate. On the badminton lawn, she got her one shot, pure as an arrow, while through the eyelets of my blouse, the no-see-ums bit the flesh no one seems now to care to touch. In the mirror, the torso looks like a pin-up hives martyr or a cream pitcher speckled with henbit and pussy paws, full of the milk of human kindness and unkindness, and no one is lining up to drink. But look, I am starting to give him up. I believe he is not coming back. Something has died inside me, believing that, like the death of a crone in one twin bed as a child is born in the other. Have faith, old heart. What is living anyway but dying?
You've said that people were uncomfortable with you being, what did you say, you're being a divorce Sherry. Telling people about it. You felt like Typhoid Mary when you were going through
Oh. I was in a crowd of long marriages with children, kind of at the center of all of our marriages. And yeah, I felt like I had harmed something. Of course, I hadn't actually harmed anything or anyone. It was 50-50, and it turns out to have been a very good thing for my life as well as his. So people change over the course of 32 years together, and I've I feel now that it was the right thing. And I'm not ashamed in front of my friends. And I've had three extraordinary relationships during that time. And I know things and I've felt things that I never would have known or felt if that hadn't happened. So, yes, but in the beginning I did. There's a poem about a long drive with an old friend wherein I confessed to him the question that was the worst thing. It's called The Worst Thing. I confessed to him that the worst thing was, and then I just started boo-hooing, I could hardly talk, was what if I had harmed love? Love, like some ideal, some... I really feared that. And then he calmed that fear, and then it was easier.
After a short break, more with Sharon Olds. You can always listen again and hear the unedited version of every show we do on the On Being podcast feed, now with bite-sized extras wherever podcasts are found.
On Being is brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation. The Templeton Foundation harnesses the power of the sciences to explore the deepest and most perplexing questions facing humankind. Learn about cutting-edge research on the science of generosity, gratitude, and purpose at templeton.org/discoveries.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, with the poet Sharon Olds at the 2018 Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her 2012 collection, Stag's Leap, which she wrote over a period of several years through the end of her long marriage.
Your newest book, your 2016 book, is Odes. And this is the one that has lots of words in it that we can't say on public radio. And I'm going to say a few of them right here, and we'll probably have to cut it out. It includes the ode to the hymen, ode to the clitoris, ode to the penis, ode to the condom, ode to the tampon, lots of others. Ode of withered cleavage, celibate's ode to balls. We can say balls on public radio.
Who knew?
I'm not going to ask you to read the ode to the penis because most of it would get, but I want to read a little bit of it because it's fabulous. I mean, in this section, it starts with, someone told me that what I write about men is objectifying. And then it ends, I like you, not as an object, but a subject, a prime mover, working theory of plumbing and ecstasy, a boy's pride and anxiety, windsock of zephyr and gale, half of the equation of creation. It's great.
Thank you.
Thank you. You wrote this poem recently, which was published in The New Yorker. I don't think it's been printed. No Makeup?
Yeah.
Yeah, would you read this one?
Sure.
And I want to tell you.
Do you have it?
I do. Oh, I printed it out. I was looking around actually this morning. I had it already in my preparation, but I read it in The New Yorker when it came out, and it was fun. And then I was looking around this morning because I wanted to print it out for you, and I came across this young woman, and did I write her? Caitlin Skinner, who has a YouTube channel. And she's a military officer, and she's young and just, you know, just lovely, smart, you know, and a very appealing human. And she's just started doing this, and the first piece she'd done on her YouTube channel is her. She's in her combat fatigues, and she's talking about what she's learned as a leader and as a mentor. And her second feed is her just not in her combat fatigues this time, reading this poem, No Makeup. And it was beautiful. So anyway, I want you to read it for us, but imagine that too.
Caitlin
Skinner.
Skinner.
S-K-I-N-N-A-E-R.
Officer Skinner. Yeah. Thank you. No makeup. Maybe one reason I do not wear makeup is to scare people. If they're close enough, they can see something is different with me, something unnerving, as if I have no features. I am embryonic, pre-eyebrows, pre-eyelids, pre-mouth. I am like a water bear talking to them, or an amniotic traveler, a vitreous floater on their own eyeball, human ectoplasm risen on its hind legs to discourse with them. And such a white, white girl, such a sickly toadstool, so pale, a visage of fog, a fizz of mist above a graveyard, no magenta roses, no floral tribute, no goddess, no grown-up woman, no acknowledgement of the drama of secondary sexual characteristics, just the gray matter of spirit talking, the thin features of a gray girl in a gray graveyard, granite, ash, chalk, dust. I tried the paint, but I could feel it on my skin. I could hardly move under the mask of my desire to be seen as attractive in the female way of 1957, and I could not speak. And when the makeup came off, I felt actual as a small mammal in the woods, with a speaking countenance, or a basic primate having all the expressions that evolved in us to communicate. If my teenage acne had left scars, if my skin were rough instead of soft, I probably couldn't afford to hate makeup or to fear so much the beauty salon or the very idea of beauty ship. And my mother was beautiful, did I say this? In my small eyes and my smooth, withered skin, you can see my heart. You can read my naked lips. Mm. Thank you. Thank you.
You know, I grew up in a small town in Oklahoma in the 1960s and 70s, and it was a real makeup culture. I mean, I actually knew people, women, young brides, who got up at 5:30 in the morning for an hour before their husband to curl their hair and put on their makeup. I doubt that that lasted very long into the marriage, but again, I could see somebody saying that this is trivial, but actually it's a huge part of the lives of women. Yeah. This makeup, no makeup, how much, how dramatic it is, if at some point you decide to wear less.
And we go through phases historically. Mm-hmm. And so it was a great shock to me to see 14-year-olds with very, very classy, very obvious and kind of gorgeous, but shocking. They had been children a couple of years before. So I think at first I thought, we're going back to the 50s. The strides that we've made and the advances that we have made were like that, and now there's going to be a dip. But I think the advances we've made are real and are not going to disappear, and they are needed in different ways all over the earth. I'm not shocked anymore, and it's luxurious for me, you know, when I cry at the movies, to just be able to wipe my eyes. But mainly I just couldn't function. Whatever way any of us, men, women, gay, straight, can function best, can let out of our mouths what we really mean, what we think and feel, then we should go for that style, whatever it is, I think.
Sometimes I feel like younger women, and I'm sure this is a generalization that doesn't apply to everybody, I feel like some of them I mean, I think about my own daughter. I think they wear makeup because it pleases them.
That's a good
reason. I don't feel like it's all about the externals, about pleasing others.
Right.
And so that's liberation.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Don't you also envy how they don't care if anybody can see their bra strap showing?
I think that's so cool.
I know. But, I mean, this is one of these things. Growing up a few decades ago.
Yeah.
Sorry, I guess you've never said that in a room. See what you're inspiring in me.
Well, I am so in agreement, and what I love is that I don't have to worry anymore. Of course, there are certainly people who think that at my age one shouldn't have a bra strap showing. But then it's also an excuse to get bras with pretty straps.
I think these girls who are 15 and or 25 now, their bra straps are going to show. And they're going to live to be 115, so that will be a whole new world.
It's going to be a tough world for them when they're getting close to 100.
Well, there's,
But we believe in you, young people, and we love you.
Yes.
We thank you.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, with the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Sharon Olds.
I would like for us to just hear some more poems before we end from odes. And I pulled out a few. I wonder if you might want to read the Unmatching Legs ode,
sure.
Because I think that also is part of the story of like where you are and with your dancing and just that piece of drama in your life right now as your life is progressing.
I have realized that this book came about as a book of odes. I was traveling with my then boyfriend, and a book of Neruda's just about fell off a shelf in an old used bookstore, and it fell on him, and he said, "Here are poems. This is a book of poems," and I read some of them: Ode to Salt, Ode to the Table, Ode to a Dog, and didn't think of copying them. They were so entire. And it was Spanish-English, and I have enough Latin and Italian that I could actually understand with the facing page. But then a week later, I thought, Odes to Common Things. And so the tampon is the first ode of this series that I wrote. And then it was also good to be able to write about sexuality without writing specific love poems to this man who would not have appreciated those poems going out into the world. I wrote them, and I have them, and I will put them into a book for him, a book of his. But that was one reason that I have some abstractions in this book. Unmatching Legs Ode. I have to give a shout out to Kwame Dawes, yo Kwame, who accepted this poem for publication, which is just so thrilling, in the Prairie Schooner. Unmatching Legs Ode. I don't know why I am fairly cheerful about my unmatching legs. I am not cheerful about my foot soles, which were like two brains reading the ground, and now have less than half their nerves. They are the numbskulls to whom I trust my balance, their surfaces crinkled tinfoil made of rubber. But when I lie on the floor on my back and look up at my lower limbs, those tapered feelers, I like them. Even though you cannot tell if the left is withered or the right fat, the right is swollen. When I was a new matron, I thought that the blue-green line down my inner calf, the great saphenous vein, was a Nile beauty mark, and the way it rose when I was carrying my first young, there was something cool in how it fit between the ledges of the gastrocnemius and soleus, like a snake between two strata of rock. So when I see the leg's mass, I am almost proud of it, that it could fit in it one and a half of its fellow. And the skinny leg, the original one, how can it be that I like the healed gouge on it from the edge of the porch stair when I fell upwards, or the one from the corner fang of his truck door? They hold the places I've been. They are like passport stamps from his kingdom. I have always liked my legs. The double stem which lifts the big odd flower of me up and up. It's as if I fell in love with them when they and I began to learn to walk together. The two of them were best friends who could press against each other and feel the love at the top of the stalks. And they were twins, not identical, but mirror twins. Loving the other was loving the self. They were ecstatics. They were the thyrsus and the stylus, the healthy narcissus. I'm sad they will rot. I wish our bodies could leave us when they are done with us, leave our spirits here and walk away.
Thank you. Would you like to tell us anything else about your legs?
I like looking up muscles and nerves and finding out their names. I like weird words. I had a political struggle with that. I long wanted to leave a pile of poems at the checkout at ShopRite. And I would look at the women who also were in line with me, and in those days they were almost all women, and wonder which of my poems they might feel welcome to. And if it had a fancy weird word near the beginning, not so much. So I tried to leave out the fancy weird words, but the trouble was I was in love with those words. And they were like magic spells. Hmm. And I've studied languages because I love them so much. I'm not good at them, and I don't know semantics or semiotics or anything like that, but I love those words. So when I'm reading that, I see, uh-oh, gastrocnemius is coming. Get ready. Yeah. And again, having experienced myself as not confident, but weird, and partly not confident because of being weird, but then developing a taste for the weirdness. And you know, once we find friends, once we find close friends, they love us for our weirdness as much as our mm-hmm. not weirdness. Mm-hmm. And so there's this woman of, I don't know, 65, whatever I was then, lying on the floor, watching her legs wave in the air. It's normal, and it's fun.
And you said to me a little earlier when we were speaking about sons, that if you wrote that again, you might note how much privilege. I think that's an overused word. I mean, we need many words to talk about what we're talking about with that word, but yeah. Right, and about him being white. And you do have this ode to my whiteness,
yes,
in this book, which I think is very an important poem.
Thank you. I would not have this ode were it not for the brilliant poet Evie Shockley's book, The New Black. And in that book, I don't remember if it's Poem to My Blackness or Ode to My Blackness, but this poem is after Evie Shockley. Ode to My Whiteness. You were invisible to me. You went without saying. You were my weapon secret from myself. Whatever I got, you helped get it for me. You were my ignorance. Because of you, I was not innocent. I did not see that. You were my blinding light. My dreams had a blank area in the center, taking up most of the screen they played on in my sleep, a blazing circle that blanked out the core of the scene. I thought it was my mother's violence, but it was you, too. You, the unseen fat which fed me in the wilderness. You, my Masonic handshake. You, my stealth. You, my drone. You, my collaborator. You, my magician's cloak of steam. You, my dissembler. You, mine. I, yours, irisless eyeball. You, my blindness, inspiration of my helpless act. You, my silence. Evie's blackness, a dancer. You, another. The two of you moving together.
Actually, I think there's... you know, this matter of whiteness is just one of these huge reckonings we have to have and many conversations. And actually think it's, I don't know that there's other poetry like this. So thank you for that contribution to our reckoning.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I wondered if we could finish with a shorter, where is it? Oh, 94. Your ode to dirt.
Ah, yes.
I don't know why. I just thought this would be a lovely way to end. It's a little shorter poem, and it's kind of about everything, really.
Thank you. Mm. And it was one of the poems in this book not written early on in the ode writing. I think for every book that comes out of mine, there's 10 times as many poems or 5 times as many that didn't make the grade. And there are early ones and late ones. And it took me so long. I couldn't bear to believe that the earth could die. I just couldn't bear to believe it, so I didn't until 2 weeks ago or whenever it was. That certainly changed my life. I'm grateful that I'm more in touch with the truth than I had been. But this poem showed a little consciousness of that. Ode to Dirt. Dear Dirt, I am sorry I slighted you. I thought you were only the background for the leading characters, the plants and animals and human animals. It's as if I had loved only the stars and not the sky which gave them space in which to shine. Subtle, various, sensitive, you are the skin of our terrain. You're our democracy. When I understood I had never honored you as a living equal, I was ashamed of myself. As if I had not recognized a character who looked so different from me. But now I can see us all made of the same basic materials, cousins of that first exploding from nothing, in our intricate equation together. Oh, dirt, help us find ways to serve your life. You who have brought us forth and fed us, and who at the end will take us in and rotate with us and wobble and orbit. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon Olds.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sharon Olds is the Eric Maria Remarque Professor of Creative Writing at New York University. Her books of poetry include Satan Says, The Dead and the Living, Odes, and Stag's Leap, for which she won the Pulitzer and T.S. Eliot Prizes. She also helped found NYU's outreach program for residents of Goldwater Hospital on Roosevelt Island and for veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Special thanks this week to Martin Farawell, Catherine Block, Paul Allshouse, David Mayhew, Julia Hahn Gallego, and the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival and Foundation. On Being is
Chris Heagle,
Lily Percy,
Mariah Helgeson,
Maya Tarrell,
Marie Sambalay,
Aaron Farrell,
Lauren Dordal,
Tony Liu,
Bethany Iverson,
Aaron Colasacco,
Kristen Lin,
Prophet Adewu,
Caspatech Kyle,
Angie Thurston,
Sue Phillips,
Eddie Gonzalez,
Lillian Vo,
Lucas Johnson,
Damon Lee,
Suzette Burley,
Katie Gordon,
Zach Rose,
and Siri Grassley.
The On Being Project is located on Dakota land. Our lovely theme music is provided and composed by Zoe Keating. And the last voice you hear singing our final credits in each show is hip-hop artist Lizzo. On Being was created at American Public Media. Our funding partners include the Fetzer Institute, helping to build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Find them at fetzer.org. Calliopeia Foundation, working to create a future where universal spiritual values form the foundation of how we care for our common home. Humanity United, advancing human dignity at home and around the world. Find out more at humanityunited.org, part of the Omidyar Group. The Henry Luce Foundation, in support of public theology reimagined. The Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives. And the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interests in religion, community development, and education.
On Being is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and is a Krista Tippett public production.